Indeed, indeed. And in a minute, the greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe, joins us as we go live to the United Kingdom on Coast to Coast AM. Lionel Fanthorpe, born in England, and has worked as a journalist, teacher, currently director of media studies at Cardiff Academy out there, fully ordained Anglican priest. And here he is back on Coast to Coast AM. Hello, sir. How are you?
Absolutely fine, George, and lovely to be with you.
Always a pleasure. Always indeed. How's family?
Family are all fine, and we couldn't ask for more. Except maybe a little break in the weather, because Wales is notoriously wet, and it's been pouring with rain.
Well, it's good to have you back with us, Lionel, for 1 hour of some of the greatest stories that were ever told. Only you can do that.
I'll do my best.
And we're working away here for you in the States. Got a couple more little plans for you that you don't even know about. So,
that sounds wonderful. I did enjoy coming over to see you and Tom and doing that work together. I thought it was great.
That was fun. We had a great time. Sci-Fi loved it. We're going to do some more work, but maybe not with that network, but there's another one right around the corner.
Hey, you got me really excited now.
Let's talk about some things. What's new in the world of ghosts out there?
Well, one of the things that I'm frequently asked about and would like to share with you and our listeners is what we might call the two different types of ghost. And when you look through the archives and when you've investigated all the things that you've looked at and I've looked at, they seem to fall into two types. And if I give you an example of each one, there's the things we call the purposeful ghosts, who just seem to be entities that have got everything we've got here, except our physical bodies. And one example of this purposeful ghost, the guy who has come back for a reason, to give a message or to do something that wasn't perhaps fulfilled in life, is the ghost of the monk in the cathedral. And he was seen by no end of the cathedral officers, as well as by various worshippers who'd come there. And he seemed to be searching the floor in one of the little rooms called the muniment room. That was a place in which money would have been counted for the cathedral funds. He was like an assistant treasurer or an assistant church accountant. And one day they had this room restored, and when the repairs were being carried out on the floor, two of the floor tiles, which were big, substantial medieval slab tiles, were moved. There was a little silver groat, a little fourpence piece going back several hundred years. And after that was sold to a coin collector at an auction, and the proceeds, which were considerable, were put into the cathedral funds, the little monk never appeared again. And the general feeling was that he had inadvertently lost it. And being a scrupulously honest man, he'd wanted to get it back. He'd realized it had gone down in between these two tiles. He just didn't seem able to get it out. And after death, it had still been, as it were, on his mind, in his heart and his conscience, that he had accidentally robbed the cathedral of money it urgently needed. And when that little coin was found, hundreds of years after it had been lost, and the funds went into the cathedral good works, then he never appeared again. He'd come back and he'd done his job. So I regard him as one of the purposeful ghosts, a ghost with an intention. Now, the second category were the ones that we might call recorded, or ghosts who are not aware and who don't have a purpose. They seem to have been, if we think of an emotional event and we think of emotional energy, that energy can be absorbed into the fabric. It can be pulled into the stonework. When we think about someone maybe recording our program now in any of the modern technological ways, then we think, okay, this is done with either an electromagnetic or a crystalline structure, whether it's a DVD or a CD or whatever method they're using. There are accidental versions of this in nature, or maybe perhaps accidental is not the best word. Maybe the best word is a natural recording as opposed to the technological ones that we do. And there's a room in York, and it's in the bottom of the treasurer's house, very deep down, and a young plumber, a guy was repairing some water pipes in there, was waiting while his boss went out to get the lunch for both of them. So he was on his own in this cellar. And he saw a procession of very tired, bedraggled, exhausted Roman soldiers making their way through the cellar. Now, where he dug that hole, he could see their sandaled feet all the way up. But on the rest of the floor, he was seeing them from the knees up, and the feet weren't there. It's as if the road that they originally walked, or the level on which they had originally marched, was now 18 inches or so below the level of the present cellar. But just where the hole was, it coincided with that original road surface, and he could see the sandaled feet. And it looked as if it was a Roman legion that had had a pretty bad time fighting the Celts and the Picts up north, and had come back very much the worse for wear, and that he'd seen, but they were no more aware of him than if you and I were watching a film or a television program.
That's weird.
Yeah, that's the second category. And when you go through it, as you say, George, it is weird. And the ghost with a purpose, like the little monk in the cathedral who was trying to put right the financial loss, he really wanted to do something. He was very self-conscious and aware and motivated. But these guys were just like a film. I don't think there was anything there. I think the boy, was the young plumber, was just seeing the equivalent of a film or a television program.
Almost like a hologram.
Like a hologram, very much so, yes. And when we think of the ancient stones from which these buildings were built, and we're only on the edge, I think, of investigating what can be accomplished with crystals. I'm sure you've had very interesting men and women on the show who were experts in crystallography, and there are some holistic healers who will use crystals to very good effect for their patients. And I think the power of the crystal to record, and then maybe this young man was sitting there thinking, hey, I'm all alone in a very old building and it's dark apart from my hand lantern. I wonder if this place is haunted. And maybe that mental attitude that he had somehow switched on the recording, the hologram, at least for him.
Can you imagine what it would be like to be down in a cellar? It's damp and cold anyway.
Yeah.
And you see these figurines of Roman centurions marching by. Probably, as you say, you know, they're there, but they're not there. And they don't notice you. It's just weird.
It's really weird. It's so strange. The idea of, it brings us up against the whole idea of what human perception is. And there's one of the other things that goes with that, I think, when we're thinking about perception, is the way that some people seem able to see the Loch Ness Monster, or they see the monster called a Morgour off the coast of Cornwall here in the UK, or somebody will see the so-called Owl Man sitting up a tree in Mornin Woods.
Tell me about the Owl Man.
Well, here's one of the phenomena that comes from Mornin Woods is just back from the coast, down in the southwest of England. It's a very old piece of forest land that's been pretty well undisturbed, I would say, for centuries. So it has that ancient natural touch about it. And it's not like a modern plantation. That was a forest that was natural in the days when wolves and bears were running wild down there. And a number of children had gone into the wood, and they, just for a bit of fun, have a picnic or whatever, or play around in the trees. And they came back and were absolutely frightened out of their wits. And they said, there's a thing like a gigantic owl. He's 5 or 6 feet long. He's as big as a human being. And he's up that tree. And on other occasions, the name, the Owl Man, stuck. And the descriptions of him varied, but he was cited by a number of, again, I would say, sensible and reliable witnesses. And one of the theories put forward to explain him and the other types of monster like Loch Ness and the Ogopogo or the Pembroke Sea Serpent that I got asked to investigate. These things link in with a theory known as phenomenology. And if you and I take, for example, a complete imaginary experience, the sort of thing we read as children, where the kids are sitting in a little boat made of chocolate and they're rowing with lollipop oars down a river made of blancmange, lovely pink strawberry blancmange, and you know perfectly well that never in a million years or a million universes could this exist. It is absolute and pure fantasy. And then on the other extent, if you go to the furthest end of the scale, you find two friends like us in a studio with a telephone, with a switchboard, and with all the broadcasting equipment that goes with Coast to Coast. These things are real. They're solid. You and I are real. Our equipment is real. Our listeners are real. And so we've got the other end of the scale, which is basic, concrete, physical reality. Now, phenomenology comes right in between the two. So you've got the chocolate river and the little chocolate boat and the blancmange and the lollipop sticks and the fairies with funny coloured hats as pure imagination. At our end, you've got pure fact. You've got two real live human beings analysing the unexplained. And the phenomenology comes in the middle. And the suggestion by those who hold the theory, and it is worth considering, is that there are some things, as you pass along the spectrum, which are neither real nor unreal. They are observable under certain conditions. They are observable by certain people who have maybe the right kind of sensitivity to do it. And theories about the Owl Man, Ogopogo, Morgaur, and Pembroke Sea Serpent, whatever, they are not unreal, they are not hoaxes, they are not imagination, but they are some kind of phenomenon, hence the name phenomenology, which almost has the power to appear at will.
Is it like dimensional?
I think so. You see, I think that that whole idea of dimensionality comes very strongly into this, George. I think that we've got to say to ourselves, look, if we know that human vision, we'll get some young man or woman with very keen sight, so as a teenager whose vision is absolutely perfect and who can see further than his mom or dad, because their eyes are now middle-aged. He can see things that are out of range for them by a few meters. And at the other end of that scale, you have the patient who has the optical problems, goes to a good optician, gets some good strong glasses, and can have his vision largely restored. And between the very bright-eyed teenager and the friend who's got the visual defect, you've got all types of seeing ability. Now, if we look at the dimensions, our perception of the dimensions, that may be something like sight and hearing in the physical world. There are people with very sharp hearing who can hear higher notes than we. Well, a dog, for example, can respond to a silent whistle, which I can't hear. Now, if we then think about the awareness of the dimensions as a varying, like the physical sight and hearing, then what we've got, perhaps, is that the man who sees the Owl Man, and it was children who seem to be more perceptive maybe than we are as adults, if somebody has extra dimensional perception, then just a little bit further than ours, nothing really strange or weird, nothing that's taking them into a completely unknown universe like Alice's Wonderland. But this man and woman can see just the edges, just the footprints on the edge of another world. And maybe that's why The kids could see the Owl Man of Moreland Woods, and if I went there hearing their cries for help, you and I go in there to rescue the kids, we see nothing. But they say, but he was there. Look, George, look, Lionel, it was up that tree. And I said, well, I'm sorry, kids, I can't see him now.
He's gone.
And I think that your idea of something from another dimension, which is just visible to those who can see further than others around the dimensional corner, that could go a long way to augmenting the theory.
It sounds like our Mothman stories. And you know, we lost John Keel a few weeks ago, Lionel.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. So sorry.
But it could. It could be Mothman stories. Sounds the same.
Yes. Yes, it could. You see, the Owlman and the Mothman, they seem to be very similar ideas. Now, if we pursue this great theory of yours about it being something to do with observation on the edge of another dimension, if human mind seems to dislike a vacuum, if I see a moving shadow, I want to make something of it. If I see something coming around a corner, I want to know if it's the guy on a bike delivering my newspaper, or is it the mailman, or I may see him as the mailman, and somebody else may see him as the newspaper man. Somebody else may think, oh, that's the grocer's boy. And when he gets closer, so that we can see more than just the shadowy outline of the man approaching from the distance, then we say, oh, yes, and we can all agree, oh, yes, that is the mailman, or, oh, yes, that is the guy delivering the groceries, or, yeah, that's, you know, that's the boy delivering the papers. So that we get this whole idea of two people seeing something from another dimension, which in the distance, which that strange dimension adds, it's something more than distance. It's like a kind of hyper-distance. Someone may see him as Owlman, and somebody may describe him as Mothman. But what they've both seen is a very similar outline, and unless both of them are in the same place at the same time with the correct proximity to use their dimensional viewing accurately, then you will get these slight differences. And I had a friend who's involved with the law and looking at the laws of evidence, mm-hmm. who said that he finds it suspicious when all the witnesses agree in perfect detail about an event. He said that makes him suspect that they've got together and cooked up a story. But if one person says, well, I think the guy was wearing a brown coat, and the other one says, no, I think it was gray, and the other one says, no, I think he had jeans on and a jeans jacket. Now, there are three honest people saying what they think they remember, and of course, as our psychologist friends tell us, what we remember is never the event itself, but we remember our first retelling of the event. That's what sticks in the mind. And so when we look at the idea of the Mothman being slightly different from the Owlman, and somebody else seeing another strange winged figure, which he might think is always it's a gigantic bat, or it's a kind of eagle man, then if we put those together, we say, yes, some honest witnesses have seen something like a bird the size of a human being, or something like a wing, like some of the descriptions, the classical descriptions of angels as figures with wings. And when we put all those together, we say, yeah, we've got honest witnesses telling us what they think they've seen. If they all said to the last feather, there were 117 feathers in each wing, and it stood exactly 2 meters tall, we're beginning to say, hey, hang on a minute, boys, have you got together on this?
Well, stay with us. If you're outside by a campfire, get your marshmallows ready, because there's more of Lionel Fanthorpe coming up with some of the greatest stories ever told. On our next Coast to Coast program, Linda Moulton Howe joins us, and she's live out there in the United Kingdom. Maybe we can get her and Lionel up there. But she's going to be reporting on crop formations and some incredible eyewitnesses on things that happened while the crop formations were being made. That'll be our next Coast to Coast show. when we come right back. Final phone calls and stories with Lionel Fanthorpe on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Lionel Fanthorpe. Lionel, tell us about the vanishing diplomat, that story.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. It's never been solved. It goes all the way back to 1809. So we're talking pretty well 200 years ago this year, aren't we? And his name was Benjamin Bathurst, and he came of a good family, as in the old British diplomatic corps, you pretty well had to in order to get in. His father was Bishop Bathurst, who was the Bishop of Norwich in those days. And young Ben had been sent out with a particularly delicate mission, and he had to go and ask the Austro-Hungarians if they would be kind enough to set up another battle with Napoleon. And he had to go through some of the territory that Napoleon controlled in order to get to the Austro-Hungarian capital to put forward the British request. And by the way, we're fighting Napoleon. Would you guys have a go at him from the other side? You can imagine that the said Napoleon would not have been very keen on that message. So we have to look rationally at the kind of physical pressure that Ben would have been under. Anyway, he arrives, he delivers his message, and he sets out to get home again, avoiding those parts as far as possible where the Napoleonic influence in France in 1809 is at its strongest. And he gets to the little town of Perlberg and decides that he'd stay there the night. Then he changes his mind. This guy is really nervous. He's under pressure from somebody somewhere. And he calls his valet and says, settle up with the landlord. I've changed my mind. We will go on tonight. Get the carriage ready. So the valet, secretary, and one of his footmen, coach driver, they get his transport ready. And Ben comes out of the inn. It's dark. He walks around the heads of the horses to get into the carriage. And as it says in all the classic accounts of the Bathurst mystery, he walked around the heads of the horses and was never seen again. There was no sign of a struggle. It's amazing. It's really amazing. He just stepped out for a moment from the light of the lamp over the door of the inn, and he might have stepped into another dimension like you and I were talking about earlier when we were talking on phenomenology. But it was one of the most sudden and, inexplicable disappearances of all time. What had happened? The various theories are put forward, rational ones. I was giving a lecture on Ben and on some of the other mysteries that you and I talk about. And a member of the audience, when we came to question time at the end, said, if it was that dark and gloomy, how did they know it was Ben who came out of the inn? And looking carefully through the accounts, it's always described as had his coat on. He was wearing a coat or a cape. Now, what if somebody had disposed of the real Ben Bathurst in the secrecy of his room in the inn, put his body in a wardrobe or got an accomplice to dispose of the body, and to continue the mystery and to make it harder for the authorities to trace him, he'd put Bathurst's coat or cape on, walked out into the light, kept his face away from the light, moved around the horses, and disappeared into the woods on the other side of the road. Now, it's one of the, and I thought it was a pretty ingenious matter-of-fact theory, but then what became of Bathurst's body? Some 40 or 50 years later, a skeleton was discovered in one of the houses in Perlberg, and Bathurst's sister, who was still alive, was called over. Now, what she could have made of an identification of a guy who had disappeared 40 years earlier is not going to be anything very accurate. And she was totally unable to identify the room. I think she was a brave girl to go and look at the remains after they'd been there that long. So there's the Ben Bathurst mystery, the guy who simply vanished and for whom there has never been any satisfactory explanation. Okay, so we know he was a kind of early James Bond type, and that guys who are in that kind of business, if you're in espionage, there will be counter-espionage agents, and the likelihood of disappearing if you are an active espionage man is probably much greater than if you are the store clerk in the library.
Can't let you get away without the story of the Green Children of Woolpit.
Oh, yeah, we've got to talk about them. It's one of my favorites. And I like the psychology of this. You know, you and I often get into the psychological pressures and the sociological sort of atmosphere and the cultural atmosphere that seems to accompany some of our most interesting stories. Now, the disappearance, or the appearance, Ben Bathurst was a disappearance. This Green Children of Woolpit story tells us about a mysterious appearance. Now, little village of Woolpit in Suffolk is either named after literally a wool pit, when wool was such an important export from Britain. And, in British tradition, the Chancellor is supposed to sit on a wool sack. The guy who is an important member of the establishment. And that goes right back to the days when wool was the main income producer in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries. So either there was a pit into which the fleeces of the sheep were placed and washed and cleaned before they were sold, or it's a corruption of the word wolf pit, because in those days the wolves did run wild in that part of East Anglia, down in Suffolk. Anyway, the village of Woolpit, typical little East Anglian parish or manor with a local lord of the manor and maybe 200-400 inhabitants. And it was harvest time, and it was during the reign of the rather unhappy King Stephen. Now, King Stephen spent most of his reign in a civil war against Matilda, who had another claim for the throne, and it was 1135 when Stephen came to the throne, and during that long civil war against Matilda, the other claimant, there was a state resembling anarchy throughout most of Britain, that he didn't have the power to defeat her, she didn't have the power to defeat him, and while the two major forces were locking horns together to decide who was going to be the monarch, the local warlords, the barons and the earls and the dukes and anybody who had a few men-at-arms was doing anything he liked pretty well in his own corner of the country, and it was a bad time. It was what our Chinese friends would call an interesting time. You know the old Chinese proverb where the guy says to you, "May you live in interesting times," and it has that deep undercurrent of interesting times are not peaceful and happy. And so anyway, it was during this period of sort of anarchy, when everybody's nerves were largely on edge and there was a lot of anxiety, that the harvesters in one of the big fields in the village of Woolpit suddenly saw two green children. Today, with our modern thoughts about science fiction and space travel, we'd have said, well, maybe they were aliens extraterrestrial. You don't know. And at any rate, they were described clearly by Ralph of Coggeshall, who was one of the monastic chroniclers. And to give these old boys their due, they were largely honest and careful and objective in the stories they told. And if Ralph of Coggeshall thought it was true enough, historical enough, to be worth writing down, then we can take it as a pretty clear historical fact that a boy and girl, green skin, and in some accounts, green clothing, stepped out of a ditch and started walking towards the men and women of Woolpit who were getting their harvest in. Now, it says a lot for the Woolpit villagers that their first feelings were of sympathy towards the kids, that it wasn't, oh, this is a demon, let's kill it. Right. It was, hey, look at these kids, are you all right? And then the kids couldn't communicate. They spoke, but they didn't speak any language that the men and women of Woolpit, the Woolpit harvesters, could understand. And it was several days before they could get the kids to eat. They didn't seem to want any of the food that the Woolpit people, in their kindness and generosity, were offering. And then the boy got hold of some green beans that someone had picked, reached for them, and the guy said, yeah, of course, here you are, help yourself. And the boy was eating voraciously, because he'd had nothing for some while, these green beans, and the girl enjoyed them as well. Now, as time passed, she lost the green colouring and looked just like a normal human teenage girl. And she was given employment in the village inn and eventually married a man from King's Lynn. And what I love about this story is that when we check the Fanthorpe genealogy, my ancestors came from King's Lynn, so I wonder whether I've got some green genes there.
The last time I saw you, you didn't look green. Well, you may have looked a little green around the gills, but you didn't look green.
Well, that must have been the good American hospitality that I'd had the night before.
That could be. Devonshire Trail of Footprints in the Snow.
Well, the Devonshire Footprints in the Snow goes back to 1855. And Devonshire, as you know, is down in the southwest. It's one of the warmest parts of the UK. And for there to be snow was pretty unusual in itself in that part of England. But this fall throughout the night in the winter of 1855, February night, was quite deep and quite extensive. And one of the village bakers was having this all around Topsham, Lipston, all around the estuary of the River X, which is a mile wide at one point. Anyhow, there's the village baker, and he notices, as he's going to attend to his ovens very early in the morning, that there's a trail of footprints going through the snow in his baker's yard. And he thought, well, wait a minute, my gates are closed. How did that, whatever it was that made the prints, get in? Now, each print was about 2.5 inches long and about 2 inches wide, and they were shaped like miniature horseshoes, as if some very small or young donkey or colt had trotted along that way, but the yard was inaccessible. While he was considering this, the village school teacher arrives, and he has with him a little posse of curious villagers who are saying, we just followed the footprints to your gate. May we have a look? Sure, come in, said the baker. And they examined them, and then they said to him, come on out, come and see what we got out here. And all through the village, these strange horseshoe-shaped prints went up to a door, up to a wall, over the top, down the other side, over a roof, and they ran altogether, when all the reports were put together, for over 100 miles. And they had stopped for no obstacle at all. They'd gone up haystacks, they'd gone over buildings, they had stopped at the foot of a building, reappeared on the roof, down the other side. And the even stranger thing was that they were in a single file. It was as if whoever had made those had either hopped. Sorry about that. That's my other phone.
Well, get it if you need. Maybe it's important.
It's an automatic fax machine. It'll stop in a second. That's got it. Yeah, sorry about that. Anyway, so here we've got this trail of footprints, one following the other. And it's as if a human being had been walking like a tightrope walk, carefully placing one foot in front of the other. They were not the kind of footprints that a quadruped would have left. These were the marks of a biped. But what it was from that day to this, no one has ever found out. All kinds of theories, as usual, that it was some kind of unusual seabird, or that it was some kind of unusual animal that had walked in that particular way. Some people even suggested it was hoaxers who had had a wheel with some horseshoes on it and had trundled it along. But then how do you dispose of the footprints of the man who was pushing the wheel? And I think the Devonshire footprints of 1855 need to go down in the annals of the genuinely unsolved mysteries.
We've got 4 minutes left. Do we have time for the story of the murder of Joan Norcott?
Yeah, we can just get that in, George. We can just get that in. Now, this goes back to a report left by Sergeant Maynard, who was a sergeant at law, not a military sergeant. And it's a 16th century account of a law case in which the suspicion was that a girl called Joan Norcott had been murdered by her husband and in-laws. The extended family lived together in a small cottage. And Joan, as the sort of senior wife of the Norcott who owned it, tended to be a dominant figure of whom the others were jealous. So there was no love lost in the family anywhere. And she was found with her throat cut, a knife point down in the floor, and the body was quite a long distance away from the knife, which had apparently been used to commit suicide. And so the theory that it was suicide was very soon thrown away, and it was decided that a murder investigation was needed. Now, the investigation wasn't getting anywhere or going very fast when prosecution said, and remember we're back in the 17th century, that it was an adage, it was a proverb, that if the murderers were confronted by the corpse of the person they'd killed, it would move again and would indicate who the murderer was. Well, several weeks had passed. Joan Norcott was exhumed, and the horrified accused in-laws were made to go past the corpse. When her husband was opposite to her, one eyelid opened, a finger was raised, and a drop of blood came from it as it pointed at him.
Ooh.
And the jury, of course, brought in a verdict of guilty, and he was duly executed.
It's almost a little bit like Telltale Heart.
It is. Very, very much the Edgar Allan Poe, Telltale Heart, yes.
Would you have liked to have met Edgar Allan Poe?
I would have loved to, yeah. I think we would have got on great.
You know what? He would have had you read his stories.
That's a wonderful compliment, and I'd love to do it. If we ever do a show like that, you count me in. I'd love to do it.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, here we are now, in a few days, moving into August, Lionel. I can't believe how fast the year is going, and it's time to pull out your old story of the night before Christmas that we will play on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day.
You know,
it's coming up again.
I'm so honored by that. I love doing that for you.
We will do that indeed. You take care. Give Patricia our best, okay?
I will indeed, George, and thank you so much for allowing me to be a guest. I love being on your show.
You're the best, my friend. Lionel Fanthorpe, as I call him, the greatest storyteller ever born. His new book out, by the way, Secrets of the World's Undiscovered Treasures. Lionel's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.